Let me just summarize a little bit about cosmological arguments. We're going to talk about design arguments, two forms, if you want to boil it down to that. Arguments from the universe as a whole. We'll actually deal with some particular items in the universe, but more the basic factors of the universe. And then in the second part of the class, we'll look at the argument from the existence of the mind. They're both versions of the design argument. But to go back to the cosmological argument, in terms of possibilities and options, there are really only three for the universe. The universe has either always existed, the universe has come into existence out of nothing by creation, the creation of God, or the universe popped into existence out of nothing for no reason and according to no cause. Those are really the only options cosmologically. So if someone does not believe in divine creation, they're really stuck with an eternal universe that is just thou, as Bertrand Russell put it in his debate with Cobbleston, just thou forever, or it pops into existence out of nothing without a cause and for no reason. And you need to press people against the wall on that. You know, not in the talk radio way, but say, look, there are only three logical options, unless you can come up with another one, and just say, can you come up with another one? Seems like there are three options. Now, there's good evidence the universe has not always existed from philosophy, the impossibility of an instantiated actual infinite. You need to explain that to the person. You should be able to do that, given the last lecture, right? Everybody learned what the word instantiated means, right? Tell me what instantiate means. Possible world? Well, no, it's related to possible world. Yes? Right. It's instanced, if you will. You have an instance of it. So it's different than substantiate, which is an epistemological notion. Show that it's the case, substantiate it. Instantiate means that the concept has been fleshed out. So we have a concept of a unicorn, but it's very, very unlikely it's ever been instantiated. Okay? So we argue that it's impossible to instantiate an actual infinite or to traverse an instantiated actual infinite. You can also argue from Big Bang cosmology, which strongly indicates, according to the best theories I think we have, that the universe came into existence out of nothing about 13 to 15 billion years ago. So if it came out of existence, into existence out of nothing, how do you account for that? And it's really a rather desperate theory to claim that it came into existence without a cause and, of course, therefore without a reason. It also means that all of existence is gratuitous and meaningless because it has no purpose. So you need to press people with their options. Do it kindly, carefully, but try to show people what the logical possibilities are, and then give the best argument you can for the creation of the universe by a moral, personal, creative being. We'll talk more about the moral principles a little bit later. Okay, with respect to design arguments, this is another instrument in our repertoire. We have cosmological arguments of different types, design arguments, moral arguments, religious experience arguments, ontological arguments. And these arguments all converge on a singular creator of the universe who is also the designer and the source of the moral law who can encounter people. That's the religious experience argument. Both of these arguments are empirical, a posteriori arguments. Design appeals to more involved aspects of nature. So when we talk about the cosmological argument, we say that nature indicates an origin. That's very basic. Somehow, the contingency of nature or the impossibility of an instantiated actual infinite or traversing it shows that there must be an origin, and that origin has its source in God. Okay? The design argument is after more than an origin. In fact, it doesn't directly deal with origin. It deals with the constitution of the universe. It still deals with contingency, but it's not contingency vis-a-vis origin. Where did it come from? It's contingency with respect to its constituency. That is, the universe is made up of a lot of different things and many different processes. And the design argument, in various ways, as we'll see, argues that the best explanation for the complexity, the order, the beauty, the rationality, and so on of the universe is a divine design. A designer outside the universe who thought it up and put it into existence. Okay? The basic form of the argument is that the universe and the objects in it show signs of intelligent design. And these signs are better explained by actual design, that is, an intelligence behind them, than by merely natural factors that, in fact, deceive us. Now, the design, if there's no God, they deceive us, because things appear to be designed. Even Richard Dawkins, the arch-atheist defender of Darwin, in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, says that biology is the study of things that appear to be designed but are not. So at an intuitive or common sense level, most people have the concept of design, or they could imagine the intricacy of the human body being designed, or the intricacy of the eye, or the intricacy of some organic subsystem being extremely complex and antecedently improbable and so on. We'll talk about these concepts in more detail as we go along. And a lot of people, I think, believe in God at sort of an intuitive level, that the universe and its form requires an explanation outside of itself. And the explanation needs to be intelligent and purposeful. But, of course, we have to get more specific than that. And, in fact, the design argument has a variety of forms. You can appeal to a variety of different types of data, if you will, or objects or laws. And there are different forms that the argument can be put into. Now, later in the class, when we talk about creation, Darwinism, and intelligent design, we'll get into the intelligent design movement and trying to explain particularly organic systems in terms of specified complexity, that's a better explanation than simply natural law and chance. And we'll talk about the design filter. We'll go into that in a lot more detail. Excuse me. The emphasis today will be more on the larger picture, but then we will shrink it down to the human mind in the second part of the class. How can you explain consciousness? Is consciousness better explained according to a materialistic worldview, where consciousness just erupted out of non-consciousness without a cause or without a reason, without a purpose? Or is a better explanation that a all-knowing mind created finite minds for a particular purpose? What's the best explanation? We have to talk about the nature of consciousness in relation to larger worldview questions. But let's first of all talk about the types of design to which we can appeal. We can talk about basic order in terms of qualitative sequences, things like the sequence of colors, tones even in the natural world, the tones used by birds or tones we encounter in the non-human world. Or you could talk about the tones and the scales and the keys of music, in fact. There are also regularities of spatial co-presence, things like the human eye. Galactic clusters have a kind of spatial arrangement and order. There are regularities, this is all right out of Moreland, regularities of temporal sequence, such as the laws of nature, the way organisms develop, even with inanimate objects. And you also have an interesting correlation between mathematical order, which is mental, and objective order. It's really quite remarkable when you think about it that human beings, simply by calculating mathematically, can understand and predict the nature and the functions of objects in the external world. Think of some of the more remarkable achievements of architecture or of spaceflight, that we could send someone to the moon and back and have the appropriate calculations, telemetry to do so, when no one had ever been there before. So why is it that these mental concepts of physics, chemistry, and so on can be mathematically formulated such that they map onto reality fairly successfully? Why is it that the inner world of thoughts and concepts relates so well to the external world? Now, this gets us into the mind-body question to some extent as well. But it's interesting, there was one non-Christian philosopher, I believe it was Eugene Wigener, I have to check the reference on that, who once wrote an article buried somewhere in my files called The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics. Now, the effectiveness of mathematics is only unreasonable on a naturalistic worldview, right? On a naturalistic worldview, mind, whatever it is, and it has to be reducible to matter, put it this way, consciousness emerges late in the history of the universe. It's not there at the beginning. It's not there before the beginning. Consciousness emerges out of material properties only. So there's no designer for the universe at large, and there's no designer for the human mind or the human body, or the relationship of the human mind and body to the rest of the universe. It's all fortuitous. So it all popped into existence out of nothing, utter fortuitousness, and then after that, it's all dictated by laws and an element of chance, possibly. Nothing else, no intelligence, no design, no guidance. But then these creatures who emerge out of the slime and gain sentience and consciousness and then gain mathematical abilities and architectural abilities and telemetry abilities and so on, are able to predict eclipses and talk about the careers of meteors and comets and send people to the moon and back and send objects across the universe. And the writer said this is all very unreasonable given naturalism. Why should an impersonal system produce entities of such great intelligence and ability? You see, whenever someone makes a claim about anything, you have to ask whether or not that claim fits within their worldview very well. It might be a case of a claim within a worldview being a misfit. So here's naturalism, matter first and matter last. The great heat death of the universe. Everything is reducible to physical properties in relationships, in fields of force, that's it. And then you have this reality of mathematics relating so well to reality. And this one philosopher says, it seems sort of unreasonable. Now let's take this claim and put it within Christian theism, mathematics relating to external reality. It's not a misfit there. It's alien, really, to this worldview, or it's at least problematic. In this worldview, it fits right in. You might be saying, where in the Bible does it say that God gave us mathematical ability to relate to the rest of the universe so he could send people into outer space? It doesn't, but if you think a little bit worldviewishly, you realize that God is a knowing, intelligent being. He created us in his own image, and he told us to have dominion over the creation. Now, that takes certain observational and conceptual and calculational abilities. Now, if God created the universe, and at the beginning was the Logos, this personal organizing principle of the universe, second person of the Trinity, the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God, all things came through him, then the universe itself has an intrinsic intelligibility. It doesn't mean we can get to the bottom of it. Only God can get to the bottom of it. The universe is filled with mysteries. If you're a finite being, you have to be baffled by mysteries fairly frequently. That's part of being finite. Nevertheless, the universe is intelligible in many ways. because we are rational beings and God is the ultimately rational and all-knowing and all-wise being. So you can develop an argument from design right there. You want to say, well, what's the best explanation? Is it that human brains evolved from preceding brains, became more and more and more complex, and they became more complex for no reason? It was merely natural selection and random forces. And we got so complex and so competent that we can engage in this higher level of mathematics and so on. Well, that's far more than is required merely to survive. It seems like a superabundance of analytical and computational ability. I mean, some evolutionists have remarked on this, some Darwinists. We seem to have a lot more brain power than is necessary merely to survive. And they would say, oh, well, just the way it is. We'd say, well, maybe the way it is very different from the way you think it is. And maybe our uniquely human capacities, analytically, rationally, and critically, are more at home, if you will, within a theistic worldview. So anytime someone makes a worldview kind of statement, you want to see whether the proposition fits in their worldview. That is, someone makes a metaphysical claim, does their own worldview support their claim? They believe it. The fellow that wrote this article, The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics, thought mathematics was effective in the world. He wasn't a skeptic about mathematics. So you take that truth claim and you say, where does it best cohere with other truth claims? Where does it best fit in a conceptual system? Right? In a Weltanschauung, in a worldview. I think we say it fits far better in theism, some kind of theism. You might talk about not only order, but purpose. And Morley makes the distinction between plan and purpose. Plan is in the mind of the designer, and the purpose is in the thing itself. We can talk about beneficent purpose, the integration of body parts for fruitful functioning, the fact that certain cures can be found for certain diseases because the body is a certain way and it's susceptible to treatment. You can talk about non-benevolent purpose. It doesn't mean malevolent, but the fact that parts work together to accomplish ends may or may not be considered valuable, but it's still a situation of purpose obtaining. You can talk about biological or non-biological purpose, the human eye, heavenly bodies, and so on. You can also appeal to simplicity. That is, you have a tremendous number and various types of entities and relationships in the universe, but the basic laws of the universe can be explained fairly simply. I don't have it with me, but Walter Bradley has done it like in about one paragraph. The fundamental basic laws of the universe can be summarized in one symbolic paragraph. The entire universe. Now, that doesn't mean it's a reductionism to physicalism. He's talking about the basic laws of nature on that level. So again, you have this vast, somewhat mysterious universe, but partly intelligible. And what do we find? We find basic laws about that world that obtain for the whole universe. I mean, that seems to indicate a plan, seems to indicate a unity that was in mind. See, it's not ultimately a chaos, it's a cosmos. So phenomena can be simplified through laws, laws of motion, magnetism, gravity, and so on. Or you can consider the complexities. They're really two sides of the same coin. Complexity of life, but explained by simple laws. Now, an argument that you can use with some people and not with others is the argument from beauty. And this argument has been neglected, I don't know for exactly how long, for at least several decades. You don't see it appearing very often in apologetic textbooks. J.P. Morley refers to it briefly. Now, why would the argument from beauty be neglected? For one thing, a lot of people are befuddled by aesthetic relativism. So in order to create an argument from beauty, you have to argue for the objective qualities of beauty. It's similar to the moral argument. to say that an objective moral order requires a moral lawgiver is to dispense with moral relativism. On the same level and in the same way, to give an aesthetic argument for the existence of God, or the argument from beauty, a particular aesthetic property, you have to try to argue against aesthetic relativism. Now, I think that can be done, but it's a difficult sell in our consumer culture, the have it your way culture, where people say that beauty is nothing but, that beauty is only in the eye of the beholder. It's nothing but a subjective experience. Now, it is a subjective experience. And in chapter 10 of Truth Decay, I don't think I required that. I give an argument for the objective reality of beauty in the world. Now, you can do this in terms of the larger universe, the non-human realm, simply the patterns of the stars, the patterns of the planets in the universe. You can talk about sunsets, mountain ranges, forests, savannas, even the stark beauty of the desert and so on. Or you could bring it closer to home and argue for beauty created by human beings. That even though you can account for a creator in human terms, that some artifacts and records of beauty, some instances of beauty, evoke a sense of transcendence. So you can say, well, John Coltrane's tenor saxophone playing in the third part of A Love Supreme is accounted for by a human being playing a metallic object with a variety of buttons and holes in it. But if you really know how to listen to it, and you know something about the genre and how the musicians are working together, at least for some of us, there's a lot more going on than that. At least we can identify that. So I think in some cases there are some instances of beauty that take you back, that startle you, where the only appropriate response is sort of a reverent silence. And you have to ask if you're in the presence of something more than the earthly, something that's actually a ray of light, if you will, from a transcendent realm. Now, how do you construct that into an argument? Well, it's partially experiential. Some people have had these experiences and some have not. But they could be, to steal a term from Peter Berger, a signal of transcendence. Could be that people have had intense aesthetic experiences and they ponder them, they wonder about them. And we as believers could say, do you know why that had such a pronounced effect on you? It's because you're more than a meat machine. You're more than an animal that processes input and gives output. You have a soul. You are able to recognize objective moral and aesthetic values. And some aesthetic values, such as the starry heavens above or some of the great creations of human beings made in God's image and likeness, are signals of transcendence. We're more than meat machines. So you can suggest an interpretation. You can try to develop the argument more carefully, but the argument may in some cases have limited value because people are so dead to the idea of objective beauty. They've been so subjectivized by consumer culture. And moreover, they've been so stupefied by systematic ugliness in our culture that they may not even be able to recognize objective beauty at all. So I think this argument can still be fruitfully employed because I think God is, I think I know from Scripture, God is a God of beauty and God is a creator of beauty. And the universe has beauty to it, even though it's fallen and groaning, awaiting its redemption. There is beauty in the universe. Beauty through human beings and beauty through simply the arrangements of the stars and the planets. In my book, Truth Decay, I give an example of a Russian physicist who came to believe in God by studying theories in physics. The theories themselves, he thought, were so beautiful that it could not be merely fortuitous, the result of everything popping into existence out of nothing and then just blind chance and blind natural laws. And when someone came and communicated the gospel to him, he was very, very receptive to it because he already believed in a beautiful designer of the universe just from looking at theories in physics. So that does happen. Peter Kreft has a very simple argument, sort of tongue-in-cheek. In one of his books, he said, the first premise is the music of Bach, the conclusion is God exists. And he says, you either get this one or you don't. Questions or comments on that? The argument from beauty. A lot of different material you can refer to. Peter Kreft, K-R-E-E-F-T, I think it's his book, Introduction to Apologetics. You know, they're having some kind of event over there, which worries me. Could someone go over and tell them we have a class and they need to turn it down? It's beautiful, yeah. No, that's the fall.
I have a question.
Yes.
How do you sidestep kind of a eugenics thing where people go, well, what beauty is, like beauty and humanity is simply what dominant culture means to be beautiful? It is true that ideas on beauty have been used for racism in the past.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to develop the case very carefully. We're not saying beauty is reducible to power. That would destroy the argument. We're saying there are objective aesthetic qualities that human beings do not control. You may perceive them or you may fail to perceive them. And can what is beautiful be misidentified? Sure. You can create bad arguments in any realm. So you'd have to go through all the qualifications and tighten up the case and make it such that it's not ethnocentric or special pleading or something like that. But I think God's revealed beauty in the natural and human world in all kinds of ways, across cultures and in the non-human universe. So there's really quite a bit to draw from here, if people are open to it. If they're not, if they're just stone cold dead to the idea of objective beauty that evokes a sense of wonder, then move on to some other data. Yeah. Right.
Do you think that works at all? It's kind of like a moral.
Yeah, actually, I'm going to try to come back to that because I try to develop that argument in connection to the argument from mind that we have mental states of love, affection. Now, can you explain the value and the significance we attribute to love if it is merely physical and chemical reactions? Is love even an ideal to strive for it if it can be exhaustively described in physical terms? So I'll come back to that. See, everyone, I think, at some level, feels love to others and sometimes feels loved and thinks that love is an ideal. At least most people do. Then the question, again, is what worldview does that best fit into? See, what gives it an ontological grounding and an explanation that retains its significance? So I'll come back to that. I've got a couple of paragraphs that I've written on that. I'll try it out on you. Yes? Well, it doesn't matter what the occasion is, as long as it's an objective aesthetic property that is recognized and seems to be better explained on the existence of an author as opposed to it being reducible to merely physical states, meaning natural laws, matter, and chance. Because that is all the materialist worldview has, if we're contrasting with materialism. Now, if you're contrasting with pantheism, everything is divine, then there really are no finite states of affairs, and there is no material universe at all. That's illusory, which presents its own set of problems. It seems to me that theism gives a deep account for our sense of awe and appreciation in the face of unexpected beauty. Now, beauty strikes in different ways at different times. That's what makes it a little tricky. And some people may respond differently to different data. But I'm saying we should suggest a way of explaining it that transcends naturalism. But the variety of data you could refer to is very deep and very, very broad. Okay. Now, on the human level, part of the difficulty is that, I'm going to sound like a hopeless snob, but just get used to it. The deeper aesthetic enjoyments require discipline. And our culture does not have very much discipline when it comes to aesthetics. We have entertainment instead. So to really understand some of the transcendent beauty of some forms of art, you have to study it. You have to learn about it. You have to compare and contrast. And many people are simply not up for that. So if they're not, fine, go on to other types of arguments. Yeah, in the back.
So much of what is thrown out today in this cultural art has been limited value. It's good for a day, it's good for a month, it's top 40 charts for a year, maybe. But you know, the study of music, Charlie Parker's been dead some 35 years now, and he's still studied daily by the person who's been around the country and around the world. The clock, the end of it, 500-600 years ago, music is still studied today. Even though it was written
Yeah, that's another indicator. We don't have time to go into a lot of the indicators, but one indicator of beauty is inexhaustibility. You can come back to it repeatedly. A great poem, a great performance in jazz, Toccata and Fugue or something. You can come back to it. Some there aren't many I would appeal to today, but some great cinema withstands repeated viewing because there's so much there to reflect on. And so it's like inexhaustible in its depth. Right, good point. All right, let me talk about another form of argument. This is called the sensation and cognition argument, and it relates to the argument from mind because there are different ways you can construct the argument from mind because the mind does a variety of things. And the mind does a variety of things that matter cannot do. This argument that J.P. summarizes is taken from Richard Taylor's book, Metaphysics, and it's a fairly influential argument. You may have run across it in C.S. Lewis, in his book, Miracles. The argument is essentially that if we are to trust our reasoning and or our perceptual abilities, we need to believe that these abilities were designed to be somewhat successful. If we believe that our reasoning and our perceptual faculties simply appeared, came up like a number in a Monte Carlo game, the way Jacques Monod put it in his book Chance and Necessity in the early 70s, then whatever experiences you have and whatever arguments you may construct would be undermined. Because there's simply no reason to trust faculties that are the result of happenstance. The result of, first of all, everything coming into existence out of nothing or an eternal universe. Natural laws, which were not designed by God. Matter, which was not created by God. Energy, which was not created by God. And chance. That is not a sufficient basis for, if you want to put it this way, grounding or warranting our ability to at least sometimes successfully understand reality. Now, there are different versions of this argument. It can be quite complex. Victor Reppert, Christian philosopher, has recently published a book called C.S. Lewis's Dangerous Idea that explores this. It's a very fine book. I endorse it on the back cover. Alvin Plantinga, one of the premier analytic philosophers alive, has given a version of this argument in various places, Warrant and Proper Function and also Warranted Christian Belief. There are different ways of putting this argument, and it can be quite complex. But it's interesting that the argument was suggested by Charles Darwin himself when he said, if my mind is merely evolved from a monkey's mind, why should I even trust the theory of evolution to be true? Sometimes called Darwin's doubt. Now, it's not only Darwin. I have a quote from a physicalist, materialist philosopher on this named Patricia Churchland. She's a little crass here, but I'll just read it verbatim. Boiled down to essentials, a nervous system enables the organism to succeed in the four F's: feeding, fleeing, fighting, and reproducing. I warned you. It's better than a lot of books I read now that just have the word out there. I'm reading academic books now with the F word just written out. It boggles my mind. Anyway, that's evolution. The principal chore of nervous systems is to get the body parts where they should be in order that the organism may survive. It's one of my favorite quotes by her. Get the body parts where they need to be so the organism can survive. And, of course, reproduce. Improvements in sensory motor control confer an evolutionary advantage. A fancier style of representing is advantageous so long as it is geared to the organism's way of life and enhances the organism's chances of survival. That's the bottom line in this worldview, this naturalistic, Darwinistic worldview. Now get this. Truth, whatever that is, definitely takes the hindermost. What she's saying is, why think that in a physicalist universe where Darwinism exhaustively explains the development of life, that these entities would know truth? In fact, she and her husband, Paul Churchland, are rigorous physicalists. And they want to reduce completely mind to brain. And they even want to get rid of classical notions of consciousness and logic and basically anything pertaining to a first philosophy. Basic logical principles that we know whatever science has to say. They have kind of this totalitarian view of science. In fact, the article that I handed out, which I'll get to in a moment, by Steven Pinker is very similar. He says we tend to think of human beings as having minds that control their bodies. But we now know from neuroscience that we are physical all the way down. How do we know that? Well, because he says for any emotion or any thought, you can find an activity in the brain. And so he says, just as we used to think that the sun went around the earth and we used to think the earth was flat, that kind of thing, we have to drop this pre-scientific worldview where we think there is, to use the classic term, a ghost in the machine. That's what substance dualism is derided as, a ghost in the machine. Because science has told us that we are nothing but bodies involving chemical and physical reactions. Yeah?
Aren't they, just what you said, aren't they sort of contradicting their own ideas? How are they supposed to argue the fact that there is no logic and no way to reason things if you can't reason things?
Well, of course. It's self-refuting. I mean, the Churchlands say things like there are no such things as propositions. There couldn't be propositions because they're immaterial abstract objects. But they have sentences. So when they explain the meaning of a sentence, they have to do it without a proposition. So it has to do with inputs and outputs. See, they have to make everything exhaustively physical. Ultimately, for the Churchlands and their friends, it's called eliminativism. That's a hard one to say. I'm only going to try once. You eliminate consciousness. And it's just inputs and outputs, all mechanically, physically explained. So propositions, numbers in a Platonic sense, thoughts in a substance dualist sense, reason in a first philosophy sense, it all has to be eliminated through the progress of science. And eventually, when neuroscience trots out all its chops, there'll be nothing left of consciousness. That's the program. It's quite radical. Yes? Well, you can parse them out differently. A physicalist claims there is nothing but physical properties. There's nothing immaterial whatsoever. Some naturalists want to claim that mind is merely a product of the brain, but it is distinct from the brain. But it's still a natural property. There's nothing supernatural about it because it depends on physical processes. It's called property dualism. We'll come back to this, or epiphenomenalism. Some naturalists who don't believe in God believe there can be... Actually, there are even some naturalists that are substance dualists. Now, accounting for the human mind in that worldview is extremely difficult. So a physicalist will be a naturalist of a certain kind. But some naturalists will grant a kind of shadowy existence to some immaterial states. But what they all have in common is they are atheists. They're non-supernaturalists. They're non-teleological. Okay? Does that help?
Yeah.
I was using them roughly synonymously there. Now, you can give two basic forms of this argument. You can give the reductio ad absurdum version or the best explanation version. The reductio ad absurdum version is, if we are nothing but meat machines, then we would have no reason to trust our reasoning at all. Even basic forms of reasoning, modus ponens, modus tollens, even analytical truths, and we would have no reason to trust our perceptions because we could be systematically deceived and still get our body parts in the right place to survive and reproduce, because that's all Darwinism cares about. Now, this gets a little bit complex, but I've got to talk to some of my smarter philosopher friends about this. I've used the reductio ad absurdum argument for years, but I think probably the best explanation argument is better. The best explanation argument is that a world in which we understand logical relationships is best explained by theism. Now, you see, if someone says, you know, if P, then Q, P therefore Q, and I say, well, if you're a naturalist, you can't even believe that because your mind was not designed with truth in mind. And the person says, look, it doesn't matter how I came to that belief, modus ponens is true because it's a necessary truth. I think that's probably right. I mean, when it comes to necessary truths, things that cannot be wrong, however you came to that belief, if you know that it's a truth, you know that it's a truth. But that wouldn't cover your perceptions. See, that wouldn't cover observations in the external world, which don't have to do with necessary truths. Have to do with taking in empirical data and making judgments. Okay? So I tend to favor, I think, the best explanation example here, that what worldview best explains the relationship of our thoughts and our perceptions to the external world. That is, that we're largely successful. We're often unsuccessful, but we can correct our mistakes. Well, if we were designed to have a certain kind of mental faculty in a certain kind of world under God to have dominion over it, then our knowledge of necessary truths, our knowledge of logical forms, our empirical knowledge, our scientific theorizing, our use of mathematics, all of that fits. These human activities and human realities, in conjunction with the greater universe, make more sense on a theistic hypothesis than on a naturalistic hypothesis. You with me? Even if you're not, just stay awake. I mean, this gets complicated, I know. But what I love is that we have the Darwin quote, we have the Churchland quote, there's even a quote I have in Truth Decay from Richard Rorty where he says the same thing. There's no reason to think that Darwinism should select for truth. Yet if you're affirming your view as true, and if you're claiming reasons to support your view, then the universe needs to cooperate with you, if you will, for your argument to have any purchase. Do you see where I'm going with that? I mean, when Patricia Churchland says truth, whatever it is, takes the hindermost, if I had her book, you know, I would just throw it across the room. Well, so much for her view. Why should I think that's true? Why should I think that's reasonable? Why does it make any sense at all? Now, the example that Moreland gives, which he takes from Richard Taylor, interestingly, Richard Taylor died an atheist. He was just sort of playing with ideas in this book. Consider a sign. We'll change it. Welcome to Denver. You see a sign on a hillside. It says, Welcome to Denver. What if that sign were accidentally formed and there was no intelligence behind it? If so, there'd be no reason to trust the message. But if someone designed the sign with something in mind to communicate a truth, then there'd be reason to accept it. So you consider our mental equipment. If it's accidental, there's really no reason to trust it, or at least it doesn't make much sense how we would come up with this knowledge in a naturalistic world, but we do trust it implicitly. So if we do trust it implicitly, we should view it as design, that it fits into the larger pattern of the universe. Now, you can develop this argument in different ways. It's a version of an argument from consciousness, the reasoning part of consciousness. There are other parts of consciousness, such as what are called qualia. Qualia is just the felt experience of things. So, you know, I'm having a qualia of a bizarrely colored container with some liquid in it. That's qualia. It's my experience of it. The qualia is not identical to the thing itself. It's my experience of it. Or if I reason about it, that this cannot be yellow all over and green all over, that's a rational operation of my mind. Or if I talk about myself, I'm kind of getting ahead a little bit, but if I talk about myself as having been born in Anchorage, Alaska in 1957, and having played Little League, and having once been paid $25 to play drums in 1975, and having gotten a PhD, I'm referring to a unified self from 1957 on. I'm really referring to an immaterial substance that has obtained, which has been preserved over time, even though the bodily configurations have radically changed. We'll come back to that. But there's a lot of claims implicit in the fact that you have consciousness. There are different operations of consciousness. And none of them, I'll come to argue in a moment, is adequately explained by materialism. Okay? But this is the sensation cognition argument. Questions or comments? You've ever read C.S. Lewis's book, Miracles? I think it's chapter 4. You've seen this argument in one form or another. He gave it in several places in his writing, but that's the most developed form of it. Yes?
In the argument, or in the book, Moreland talks about the advent of neuroscience. It talks about, you know, activating the brain, and then he talks about the ideas. And then, for example, he has the idea of a ball that's pink, but the brain doesn't have pinkness in it. I don't think I entirely understood that. What does neuroscience tell us about every thought we have or every feeling we have has some kind of physiological thing? Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't think it does, because what you have is you can correlate mental states with physical phenomena. A correlation is not an identity. What you need is identity. Because, you know, given the law of identity, something is what it is and does not possess qualities it does not possess. So if you say the same thing possesses opposite qualities at the same time, opposite properties, the same thing, in the same way, then it cannot be the same thing. We'll come back to that. But see, that's Pinker's argument. You hear it all the time. well, we can correlate felt states with physical phenomena. I want to say, so what? That's correlation. You're not going from the third person to the first person. That's where the problem lies. And science will never move from the third person to the first person through any amount of experimentation, through any theorizing. They're just at their limit at that point. They don't want to admit it. Because a lot of people that suffer from the epistemological disorder called scientism think that science is the only method of knowing. And it has slowly been taking more and more things into its grasp, and eventually will take the human mind completely into its grasp. It won't. And that picture that scientism is the way to know is actually self-refuting, as we'll see, and it simply is false. Because there are a lot of things now that cannot be explained on naturalistic scientific grounds, such as the origin of the universe, the origin of life, and so on.